I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it An American Conversation with Global Attitude. This one is about a rock slide in motion in American finance, which means the world economy too. We're looking over the brink with one of the great long-term investors of the age. John Bogle grew the Vanguard family of funds over 35 years, past $1 trillion in value. But John Bogle is an insider who thinks and writes and invests like an outsider. He's a common sense sort of common man, or says he is, and he's often a very tough scold of his own industry. John Bogle, so glad to have you on Open Source.
Right, glad to be with you, Chris.
We're talking on Friday, September 25th, before the first McCain-Obama debate. There's no bailout agreement in place yet, so we need perspective and wisdom that'll get us past one weekend's mood. Give us the Bogle big picture here. What do you call this crisis? How do you describe it to your grandchildren, say?
Well, I guess I'd call it, I haven't thought a lot about that, to be honest with you, but I guess I'd call it the Great Avalanche. You know, the snow came down from the sky on Wall Street, brought down by Wall Street, and the snow piled higher and higher and higher, and it enriched Wall Street fabulously beyond the dreams of avarice, and it piled up so high that it couldn't pile up anymore, and an explosion went off, and down it came on the innocent victims of the whole financial system. And sometimes not so innocent victims.
Can we see the bottom of this abyss, to mix our metaphors even more?
And that's a good word. Nobody ever knows where the bottom will be. But my judgment is that the bottom is maybe from an economic standpoint, a standard of our economy, straightening out the credit situation, bringing some liquidity back to the system, bringing a certain amount of greater activity to the markets, is probably the bottom of that, you know, the beginning of that recovery is probably somewhere between 2 and 3 years away.
Wow. And how deep is the hole?
Well, the hole is very deep for the credit side of the business. We've had a whole bunch of factors that added together gave us, you know, this giant blizzard that turned out to be to create this avalanche. The worst part of it all is we broke the link in the chain that relates the lender to the borrower. And that is to say, if you remember the movie It's a Wonderful Life,
sure,
that little savings and loan, the Bailey Savings and Loan, I think it was called, when they lent you money, they lent it on your character, on your income. They knew all about you in the small town. And the reason they had to be very careful lending you money is because that debt sat on their books, and they had to be darn sure it got repaid because they'd taken money from depositors to lend it to you. So they didn't want to make bad loans. They had a vested interest in making good loans that would get repaid, good loans to good citizens at reasonable terms. All of a sudden, it became possible, almost overnight, to package for the Bailey Savings Loan, if you will, although I'm sure Jimmy Stewart never would have done it, to package those loans, unless Lionel Barrymore said, you got to raise the earnings of this bank. And there were a lot of Lionel Barrymores out there. But in any event, breaking the link between borrower and lender was just, talk about having obvious consequences. I mean, you could see this coming, Chris, honestly, years in advance.
We were warned. You're saying important things about the causes here, John Bogle. I'm still fascinated by the dimensions of it. You say you're talking 3 years of pain, and this is automatically a kind of global problem. It's intriguing to me. Sarah Palin, talking with Katie Couric, started the talk of a Great Depression. Just what would make it, what would trigger a Great Depression, and what in this moment might prevent it?
Well, I mean, let me be clear that I don't think some Great Depression is etched in stone here. I don't think it is necessary we have a Great Depression. And what would prevent it is if we ever get it right in Washington, D.C., and I know that's asking a lot, and if you read the notes of yesterday's meeting at the White House, it's an embarrassment to the country. Washington ultimately will probably get it right. There were, I think, 4 op-eds in the Wall Street Journal today, and even an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, not exactly a bastion of what is called liberalism, that all got it right. There are ways to do this intelligently, and the fact that our Secretary of the Treasury, who happens to be a former investment banker, got together a scheme that would help the banks and investment banks and not help the poor, hurting mortgage holders, borrowers, and didn't even want the investment banks and banks to pay anything for this enormous purchase, $700 billion purchase of assets that were underwater, are underwater. There has to be a lot more, and I think we will get a much better bill.
You speak of that that cast in the White House meeting all lined up at the table. I'd love you to be as personal as you like and review the players here, like a color man on at the World Series. I mean,
well,
Bush, Paulson, Chris Dodd, Barney Frank.
Here we got one great example. But the meeting is falling apart. Representative Boehner, the Republican leader, says we're just not going to go with it. And I guess they'd been brought in there to have like a summit meeting where the parties have frank talk and come out with a communique that says they both believe the sun will rise tomorrow.
Yes.
But here, it immediately generated, apparently, into really kind of a nasty fight. And one of the more amusing anecdotes is subscribed to by several people at the meeting is or attested to by several people at the meeting is Secretary Paulson gets down on his knees, on a knee, I believe, and begs Speaker Pelosi,
yes,
to back this. She's of course a Democrat,
and not to talk about the meeting. What did that tell you?
Well, first, Senator Pelosi or Representative Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi said to Secretary Paulson, "I didn't know you were a Catholic." To which, and then said, "You know, it's not the Democrats; it's the Republicans that are causing all the problem." To which Paulson responded, I know it's the Republicans." And then out walks Senator Shelby, a big, strong Southerner, Alabama, and leaves the meeting before it's even over and walks out and says, "The agreement is no agreement. You know, it's chaos." And I got in a little trouble saying the Treasury was acting punch drunk.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I may have been wrong when I said it, but I'm sure right today. So that's not the stuff of statesmanship.
John Bogle, Paul Krugman, too, was calling for, you know, it's time for the grown-ups, but where are they? Who gets it, in your view?
Well, there are a lot of people that get it. First, one Lucian Bebchuk wrote today on the, he's a professor at Harvard Law School, about the need for the government. You can't give this money to the banks. There's just no question about that. They've got to get something in return. And they've got to have an ownership position.
Mm-hmm.
You can also read in today's Wall Street Journal John Paulson, a hedge fund manager who maybe is a little bit discredited. I don't think he should be necessarily. But his hedge fund made so much money that he personally made, I hope your listeners are sitting down, $3.7 billion last year. And he says the taxpayers are entitled to be part owners of these companies if we're giving them all this, buying all these mortgages from them, and nobody even knows at what price. Another one who gets it right, and I believe, without any evidence at all, except what I read in the paper, I mean, except the evidence of the deed itself, I believe Warren Buffett gets it right. He goes to help the biggest and most successful and least under pressure firm in Wall Street. That would be Goldman Sachs. And he extracts from them almost a devil's bargain.
Yes.
He demands, he gives them $5 billion or buys $5 billion worth of securities. My understanding is it's going to pay him an interest rate or a dividend rate of 10%.
Yes,
and
plus
if they want to pay and if they want to pay him off, he's going to get $5.5 billion back. I mean, he's saying, I'm going to give you money and I want to participate in the ownership of your business. And, you know, if you think about it, the federal government, which is, I think, embarrassing, really, didn't even think about, the Treasury Department, apparently didn't even think about asking for an ownership stake in return for all this help.
But now, that's a key point. But that also sounds like state capitalism, John Bogle, and a big violation of the American way. Just what do the people deserve as a payback for their pain here?
Well, I mean, I guess I'd say, and this is maybe a little bit cynical, when Dubai buys a share in a bank, when Singapore does, when South Korea does, when Shanghai does, they get an ownership stake in these Wall Street firms. They've all done it, and they get it. And I'm not sure, I mean, I'm a little bit skeptical about how well it will all be work, and I certainly share your skepticism about state capitalism. But the fact of the matter is that what we have done in this great nation of ours is what we have privatized the rewards of the financial system and socialized the risks of the financial system. So having done that, the question is, should we get nothing for it? And in the name of not having state capitalism, or should we get something for it that we're entitled to basically say we're going to have a little state capitalism? Well, the state capitalism is a phrase. I don't think any of us really know precisely what it means. But what it means to me is the state represents the taxpayers, not the government. The government doesn't pay anything. The taxpayers, our citizens who are paying for this, deserve to get what foreign countries get if they do the same thing, and deserves to get what Warren Buffett does if he does the same thing.
And they'll deserve to get shareholder uprisings down the road, too.
Well, I think what you do about that, honestly, and there's an awful lot still to be written on this, is I think the government somehow has to neutralize itself as a voting force, an economic force, but not a governance force, as they should be. Now, I don't know, but there are lots of ways to do that, and that's not something that hasn't been thought about before.
But, you know, I'm still groping for a name for this crisis. If this is the end of, you know, tough sink or swim market capitalism, what is it the birth of?
Well, not to be argumentative, but
go ahead.
I'll just tell you what something about capitalism. And I somehow remembered this, I don't know how, from the first edition of Paul Samuelson's textbook, Economics and Economics, an Introductory Analysis, my first taste of economics at Princeton University in 1951. And what Paul Samuelson said in his introduction was, the problem with capitalism, like the problem with Christianity, is it's never been tried. And when you think about it, of course, it's true. We've had a very fettered capitalistic system. We've had a lot of monopolistic practices. And we've had a lot of illicit price fixing along the way. You know, it's supposed to be gone now, but I'm not sure it is. We had fixed commissions in Wall Street where you paid 35 cents a share, whether you bought 100 shares of stock or 100,000 shares up until 1974. We have retail price maintenance coming back again. We have collusion. We have a lot of problems with capitalism. And we have made even worse by the fact that, you know, the administration was wont to say, and this is another major part of this problem, not that we haven't identified enough major problems, but a major part of this problem is something that began to happen 50 years ago and has totally changed the nature of capitalism in the most fundamental possible way.
And that is
50 years, and the Bush administration talked about an ownership society. We want to have an ownership society. The ownership society began to vanish 50 years ago, and it is gone today, and it is never going to return. Example, 50 years ago, individual investors owned 92% of all stocks, and financial institutions owned 8% of all stocks. Mm-hmm. Financial institutions are agents for investors. Today, an individual share has shrunk to 24% from 92. An institutional share has gone from 8% to 76%, a revolution in ownership. But instead of having ownership capitalism, we have manager's capitalism, where corporate managers and money managers, institutional money managers, control corporate America and don't give a damn about what's going on there. Why is that? Yet another aspect of that. You're going to be exhausted, Chris, by the time we get through this.
This is getting good.
But these new agent owners, A, aren't representing their principals. These mutual fund investors, mutual funds own 34% of that, about half of that of that institutional total, 34 of 76%, and pension funds own a lot of the rest, endowment funds a small portion, labor union funds a tiny portion, but it's basically mutual funds and pension funds that are the dominant shareholders today. And they don't, they have not only betrayed their principles, P-A-L-S, that the mutual fund shareholders, for example, are supposed to represent, and they represent themselves, they've also abandoned their own investment principles, P-L-E-S. And that is to say, institutional investors used to be long-term investors, and now they're short-term speculators. So this is, if nothing else, the age of speculation, and it's got to come to an end. But, for example, this is the most speculative age recorded by numbers, that the numbers verify, in the history of America. In 1929, we had 140% turnover stocks. Usually it's been, in my early years in the business, maybe 25, 30% turnover a year. Last year it was 280%, twice as high as 1929. And it's all speculation, which is investors, market participants, not investors at all, trading stocks back and forth with one another.
John Boger, you have been among those who warned us for a long time now about the financialization of our own economy, the substitution of trading and speculating for making and doing. I don't know, do you ever feel that you were in on or witness to the making of a monster?
Well, I guess, yes. I feel a little, every once in a while, do I feel like Dr. Frankenstein? Sure. But down at Bedrock, we created a company here at Vanguard whose claim to fame is that virtually every penny that we earn from our investments goes to the mutual fund shareholders we have. We operate at cost. There's no profit motive in the operation of Vanguard, where all the other mutual fund firms are in business basically to make money for themselves, not for their shareholders. And we therefore have this claim to delivering the highest possible share of whatever returns, delivering to our investors the highest possible share of whatever returns our stock and bond markets are kind enough to deliver to us. We take less than anybody else, less.
But in terms of the growth, I mean, the finance is now one of our giant industries. Should we say alongside manufacturing or agriculture, just the management of money absorbs a huge piece of the American energy and our product. How long can this go on?
That cannot go on any longer. And I'll just give you a little example. In 2006, before last year, financial companies, financial sector was making about almost 40% of the total earnings of all American corporations put together. Unbelievable. And what's bad about it is there are some industries and some activities that add value to society. Agriculture, certainly, things that we take for granted, like carpentry, plumbers, electricians, builders, engineers, aircraft, aeronautical engineers, electrical engineers, people that are sending planes up into the air and across the world, they're all value-added. They cost money, but they deliver greater value. In the financial services sector, it is a value-subtracting business by definition. The economists call these rent-seeking businesses. I don't know where the term really makes much sense. Didn't make much sense to me. But a rent-seeking business is someone who is an intermediary between two parties. So the rewards, you know, party A wins and party B loses. And the rent-seeker in the middle, the money manager, the trader, the government, the lawyer, say a lawyer has a client who wins $1 million and a client who loses $1 million, but the client who wins the million only gets $800,000 because of the legal fees involved. They both get $900,000.
Right.
He creates no value net because Mr. Party A is enriched and Party B is impoverished, so value is zero until you take the croupier's cut. I call them the croupiers, and investment management. Think about this for a minute. It's so obvious if you think about it, and that is all this trading that goes on. There's a buyer on every trade. And I hope your audience is again sitting down, Chris. There's also a seller on every trade. So there's no such thing as buyers rushing into the market. because they've got to buy from somebody, and that somebody is called a seller. So they are net-net even. They buy at a certain price, and then the seller pays the same price, except that that Wall Street croupier takes out, counting money managers and brokers and investment bankers and all the other, you know, and variable annuities, investment advisors, the whole thing, takes out of our system $650 billion a year. That is a net loss, a net value subtracted from whatever the return the markets earn.
John Bogle, let me ask. Have you counted up the global implications of this setback in American markets? At the United Nations opening sessions this week, national leaders from all over the world have been saying that the U.S. preaches but doesn't practice market capitalism, and that the American design of prosperity and growth is discredited every day. What do you make of it?
Well, I mean, I think that's, you know, it's an interesting point and not a bad point. But the fact is, the American system has given us the most productive society in the history of mankind. And the fact is that while most of these countries that are complaining, take the European countries, are growing at a half of 1% or something like that per year in terms of population, the U.S. is growing at about 2.5% a year in population, simply because we have huge immigration. And that is, America is where people from around the world want to go. You know, we've done a lot of things wrong, but we haven't, you know, we can recover from it. You've got to be an idealist to believe that, but I am an idealist. Interestingly enough, by the way, Chris, if you own U.S. stocks, you are in, even in this year, with the U.S. market off, give or take, 16 or 17% year to date, it's about the best performing stock market in the world. The European markets off about 24%, almost half again, more than that. And the emerging markets are off, you know, about 35%, twice what the U.S. is off. So there are plenty of problems to go around. And I guess I'd say and I acknowledge that we have serious problems. God knows anyone who's listening to this knows that. I've already acknowledged it many, many times. But I'd say when some of these chaps from across the pond or across the Pacific, whatever that is these days, I'd say, if I can be a little bit biblical on your show, Chris.
Sure.
Let he who is without sin cast the first stone.
All right. You've given us the good news and the bad, or the bad and the good. Play Uncle Jack here and tell us what to do with our measly little nest eggs now.
Well, the main thing probably is, well, let's start with who you are. If you're a speculator, and too many of us are, I would say, as I said a year ago in June, if you're a speculator, I don't like this market, and I would get out, and I would get out now, and I would stay out. I don't speculate, and I have no basically credibility to give a speculator advice, but it turned out to be right on the money. However, if you're an investor, and that is to say someone who believes in owning business and earning the return on capital that corporate America has earned and will earn, maybe not this year or next year, but will definitely earn because they have huge amounts of capital. You know, our stock market is worth roughly $14 trillion, $15 trillion, and that kind of capital is employed in manufacturing and a whole lot of very useful industries, healthcare, technology, consumer goods, discretionary goods, and so on, energy, and all those things that really do add value. And capitalism will out over there in the long run because the value of the stock market, Chris, if I can just add on a very important thought, it turns out that the stock market is a giant distraction to the business of investing. And as I say, we look at the stock market going up and down. Does anybody think that the value of 3 or 4 days ago, the value of American business rose $1 trillion on one day and fell $1 trillion the next day? Well, that's what the stock market did.
Right.
But the American business, at the end of last week, was probably worth a tiny amount larger. It was worth more than it was at the beginning of the week, just because they had another week to earn some money on their capital. So for the investor, I'd say if you're young, you should keep an exposure to equities and just weather this storm. Invest now when prices are lower and keep investing. Don't bury your plans. For older people like me, you know, I've been about 68 or 69% in bonds I haven't made a change in my asset allocation since 2000, the early in 2000 when that previous market peak was reached, and we're even a little bit below that now. But I'm very comfortable doing nothing. I mean, I wish I had nothing in stocks when it's going down, but then the next day it goes up more than it went down the day before. Who knows? I'd say get your balance right. Make sure you've got a careful allocation, an anchor to windward, we might say, or some powder dry, because, you know, bonds produce more income than stocks. When you're older, you need income. But B, because even if you're younger, a small bond position will maybe keep you from doing something really stupid. If the market plummets, it will give you a little protection from the plummeting market. And then be very, very diversified. Don't own a stock or two. You might own AIG. You might have owned Lehman. Own the entire U.S. stock market and the entire bond market for your bond portion, and just fight it out. Now, I can't tell you how that will come out. I wish I knew how it would come out. But I think you'll get a constructive return, a positive return, albeit lower than the long-term return on stocks, over the next decade. And if you don't think you can make it through the next decade in a variable stock market, I'm afraid, even if you're an investor, you just ought to get out. It's not a place to be if you can't afford to lose anything. The other thing is really an important piece of advice. The single most important piece of advice I think I'd give your listeners comes from Pascal, writing it around, you probably know better than I do, Chris, the 16th century. And that is, think about the probabilities that lie ahead. I've expressed my own views on that. The stock market may have anticipated the bad economic consequences. It may not. But think about the probabilities. Make your own up mind. But then think about the consequences if you're wrong.
And this is Pascal's wager.
Pascal's wager, exactly. And so if the consequences are dire if you're wrong, you just have to be more conservative.
John Bogle, last question for me. You've said in the past that emotions are an investor's worst enemy. Get us past the huge anxieties of this moment, even about a three-year deep dive that you're forecasting here, to a value investor's appraisal of what is going to survive.
Well, the financial sector will shrink greatly. Things like the healthcare sector, the technology sector, the energy sector, they will grow. The consumer sector will grow. There will be growth in the economy because, A, we have higher productivity. We've been lucky to have it in the past, and I believe we'll have it in the future. And then we've got population growth to add to that. And I think over the next 3 or 4 years, I'm not sure how this will be reflected in the market, but I think America will continue to grow. And, you know, we might have a recession. I don't think we're going to have a depression, but everybody ought to make up their own mind about that. I can't tell you we won't have a depression, because I don't know, and I don't know who does know. And I'd be very cautious if someone says they know the answer to that question, because nobody knows. It depends not only on consumers' ability to spend, but on consumers' confidence in spending. So, you know, if there were no uncertainty, returns would be very, very low. If there's uncertainty, returns get higher, volatility is higher, having a strong stomach is more necessary, and trying to have the ability to be detached, and I would argue, try not to peak at your investment account. Stay the course is the phrase I use for it. That's what I'm doing with, admittedly, a very conservative position, probably about right for people my age, however. And the young people have so much time going for them, and the power of capitalism, even fettered capitalism going for them, and the power of growth, the power of technology, the power of new ideas and entrepreneurship. And my guess is that's going to prove to be decisive, but not to create the kind of returns we got, anywhere near the kind of returns we got during the 1980s and 1990s. Look for an era of subdued returns, but I suspect positive returns.
John Bogle, you're the voice of experience and wisdom in this conversation. It's a huge pleasure to hear you on Open Source.
Well, it's good to be with you.
Thank you, John Bogle.
Very good, sir.
John Bogle, I should add, has written 8 books since his heart transplant 11 years ago. His new book is called Enough, the Enough part drawn from Joseph Heller's comment to Kurt Vonnegut. When Vonnegut said at a party, "How does it feel to know that the hedge fund guy at this party made more money last year than you made on all your work is a distinguished American writer, the author of Catch-22. And Joseph Heller said, I have something he doesn't have. What's that? I have enough. Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation with John Bogle. Post your own hopes and dreams and fears for capitalism, for your own nest egg, in a comment at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for joining us.